I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com. This episode is brought to you by Bitdefender, team partner of Ferrari. Visit bitdefender.com to learn more about how Bitdefender supports Ferrari to stay ahead of cyber threats and how you can make your digital life safer. When F1 drivers change teams, they take all of their experience with them. It's the same for engineers, and Simone Resta has a lot of experience. From his start with the former Minardi team to many years at Ferrari, Simone has worked with or designed cars for some of the greatest drivers in F1 history, like Michael Schumacher, Fernando Alonso, Kimi Raikkonen, and Sebastian Vettel. And while the car is crucial, he knows great drivers can make a difference.
When you got a car that is not in an happy place, there are drivers that can drive over the problems, and there are drivers that struggle to cope with that and just take a bit of a step back. So this is, for me, is a characteristic of a driver where you really see someone that can drive over the problems, can cope with the problems, and just keep extracting the maximum.
Today, Simone is working with George Russell and Kimi Antonelli as Deputy Technical Director of Mercedes. His switch to the Silver Arrows took a lot of thought.
In my career, I've had many times the dilemma about what I was doing, and I never felt it was the right time. But then I felt, for the first time, very loud the voice in me that it was the time to change it, and I just went for it.
Here on F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, Simone tells us how he's looking ahead to F1's new rules in 2026, what he learned in his early days at Minardi, and what engineers like him really want to hear from their drivers. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Simone, it is lovely to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your time. How are you enjoying life at Mercedes?
Thank you, Tom, for having me here today. It's great to be at Mercedes. And we made a step over the winter. It's been positive. It's been nice. There's quite a nice energy in the team. Of course, it's not enough because, you always try to achieve more and aim for more. But it's a nice step.
Can we delve a little deeper into that step? Where have you found performance in 25 that you didn't have in 2024?
I mean, of course, the power unit is frozen going into 26 now. And so therefore, you need to work on everything else. We had Lewis going to Ferrari, and we got a new, very fresh driver lineup with a lot of energy. And we got complete new aerodynamic clothing of the car. We've got changes in the suspension, changing in the chassis, and so on and so forth. So there are a lot of things we did.
In what areas are all the teams, not just Mercedes, but in what areas are all the teams still looking in 2025?
There is still a certain amount of understanding on the cars, how the behavior is with those cars, with the ground effect, and you know, the way that the floor is working, the way that the porpoising is affecting some of the performance in some of the condition. There has been changes in terms of the tires last year to this year. So in those areas, I think there is still something to find and something to understand to exploit it to the limit.
James Allison last year, on this podcast actually, talked about a eureka moment inside the Mercedes team in which you finally understood how to unlock the potential in the car with these current regs. How's the team's development trajectory been since then? Has it ramped up massively?
I think the team was finally able to understand the main performance limitation on the cars at some point, let's say in spring last year, and then was able to agree development direction, and then we just kept going on this direction, and we kept adding more and more objectives and trying to fight opportunities on the car. So that, I think, was a key pivotal moment for the development of the car, but there have been also other stuff we've been finding and developing in the meantime.
Tell us more about your role now. You're deputy technical director, but all of the teams are now juggling the changeover between the current car and, of course, the 2026 regulations that are requiring so much effort. How are you working that at Mercedes? How are you dovetailing the two programs?
I mean, clearly, being at Mercedes, you always wake up in the morning and trying to fight for the best, whether it is 25, whether it is 26. The objectives are always very high, and we are trying to manage both of them. Clearly, we are limited in resources, so it's always a balance between managing the two projects. As far as my job is concerned, I'm mainly concentrated about 2025 season at the moment, and whilst James has got more time now to focus more on 26.
Simone, you've been involved in F1 for, what is it, 30 years now. Is this upcoming rule change the biggest that you have witnessed?
We've had very big changes. We've had a big change in 14 with the new power unit. We've had a very big change in 22 with the new aerodynamic regulations and the tires, etc. This, I think, is a step over the previous ones because it's combining the two things. It's effectively, it's combining tires, it's combining aero, and it's combining power unit and chassis regulations all in one shot. So it's a very demanding effort for all the teams.
Looking at 26, for people listening who aren't technical, can you just explain the process of how you approach a new regulation set? I guess step one is to read the rule book. What is step two?
Step one, in terms of timing point of view, has been to take care about the power unit, because it's been the part that has been defined earlier and on which we could do work earlier. The chassis regulations have been a kind of work in progress for some time. And finally, that every team has been able to work on the aerodynamic development. A complete vehicle project is featuring all the things together, but the different components are developed on different timelines. And for example, on the aerodynamic part of it, it has all started since January, for example.
Will the 2026 cars generate lap time in a different way to the current car?
I think so. I think one of the objectives for the drag is to be lower. The way the power unit will deploy the lap time is going to be different, of course, without the M2H and with a different level of M2K. The tires will be smaller, so there will be probably a different grip, but also different degradation. The aerodynamic load will be lower, probably. You know, the cars will be also more nimble, like narrower track, shorter wheelbase. The weight is going to be quite lower of the overall vehicle. So it's going to be a big advantage as well in terms of lap time.
From everything you've just said, will the cars be faster in a straight line compared to now, but slower through the corners? Is I know that's very generally speaking, but is that what you're expecting?
Broadly, yes.
And will the drivers have to drive them differently?
I think that we'll have to learn how those cars will be in real life. At the moment, there is a lot of work on the simulation side, but of course, we'll have to see how this will translate. Once, let's say, in about an year time, we'll have an understanding about how much we'll be able to extract from those cars. So there's going to be a lot of work to get there. We'll have to have a better understanding about the aerodynamic rules. We'll have to have a better understanding about the tires in their final stage at the moment they are. So I think it's quite early at the moment.
Let's talk drivers. Tell us, first of all, about the job that George Russell has been doing over the last 18 months.
You know, I met George for the first time in October this year. So, like I said, it's been 6 months from now. And I've seen him working together with Lewis and trying to learn from one of the best in our sport, the best ever in our sport. You know, of course, now for him has been the time also to step up and becoming the more senior driver in the team and giving the way to Kimi, showing you know, everything that he has learned in those years and try to have help Kimi's growth in the meantime. And he's been doing a very good job. I think he's really stepped up very well in the team. And yeah, we are quite happy so far.
What do you see as George's greatest strength?
He's very young and he's very keen to develop himself. But on the other end, he's also having quite a good experience because he has had now several seasons in F1. And he knows very well the team, he knows very well the people, and he's in a very good stage to express his potential with the team now.
Is he a very astute racing driver? I mean, strategically, he seems to be on it. I remember, I know you weren't at the team at Spa last year, but he was calling that strategy early in the race. Equally, even China this year, I think he was one of the first drivers to say, we can do this on a one stop.
Yeah, I think he's a very smart driver to understand those things and to be ahead in taking those decisions.
Go on then, what about Kimi Antonelli?
Kimi is just 18. I mean, he's got the same age of my son and he's coming in Formula 1 very, very quickly with even jumping Formula 3, just 1 year in Formula 2, and he's been doing a very nice job. He's, if you consider his race in Australia, for example, you know, he started from the back of the grid for an issue on the floor that we have had during quali, starting, I think, P16 in Australia, and then, you know, on the wet, in a track that is quite difficult even on the dry, but on the wet is even more difficult, in very difficult conditions. We have seen champions on the track having issues, and, you know, it's just one little error at some point, and then all the rest is a very clean race. He's been able to have very nice maneuvers, very good overtakes. What would you ask for?
He's very brave, isn't he? He strikes me as very brave.
I'm not sure if I would say very brave. I think he's got the raw talent, the raw speed to do that, and he's quite calm as well. I mean, of course, he knows that he needs to keep improving, and he's on a very quick learning slope for developing himself. He's still learning how to extract the maximum from the tires in quali, so I'm sure more is to come from him. He just need to give him the time to develop himself.
Simone, take your Mercedes hat off for a minute and put your nationalistic flag up. Just how important as an Italian is it to have an Italian driver back at the front in Formula 1? Because it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. I remember last time I've been working a bit with Antonio Giovinazzi when I was at Alfa Romeo Sauber. It's great to have Kimi there. He's probably, since many years, he's the first driver that is fighting for a car capable of you know, achieving podiums and wins. He's a great asset for the Italian motorsport. Yeah, everyone is supporting him, and I think it's just the start of potentially of a great career for him. So I think everyone is gonna be quite excited as soon as step by step he's gonna express more and more results.
This episode is brought to you by Bitdefender, team partner of Ferrari. In cybersecurity and Formula One, every millisecond counts. Only the most advanced cars and dedicated teamwork win races on the track, and only the most advanced security technology and elite specialists have the power to prevent, defend, and stop cyber attacks. Technology makes all the difference in who has a clear advantage, where Bitdefender is renowned for driving leading-edge innovation in cybersecurity. Bitdefender helps safeguard the data of Ferrari. They supercharge the cybersecurity team's ability to swiftly identify and respond to any threat that arises. Bitdefender has earned the trust of Ferrari for its commitment to innovation and for being at the forefront of cybersecurity to manage continuous and evolving challenges. Join the millions of consumers and businesses that trust Bitdefender to protect their digital worlds. Visit bitdefender.com to learn more about how Bitdefender supports Ferrari to stay ahead of cyber threats and how you can make your digital life safer.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
You've worked with many of the great drivers of the modern era. Tell me if I've listed them all, but Schumacher, Alonso, Raikkonen, Vettel, Hamilton, both of the guys you've got now.
Yeah. Leclerc.
Leclerc as well. I knew, yeah, I'd forgotten one.
Right.
Exactly. Thank you. What separates the great drivers that we've just mentioned and the good drivers?
I suppose they are all different. There's not just one single characteristic, let's say, to define those clusters. I suppose there are characteristics that are quite unique and make the difference. For example, when you got a car that is not in an happy place, in terms of balance, in terms of characteristics, in terms of consistency, there are drivers that can drive over the problems, and there are drivers that struggle to cope with that and just take a bit of a step back. So this is, for me, is a characteristic of a driver where you really see someone that can drive over the problems, can cope with the problems, and just keep extracting the maximum. Or there are drivers that, for example, during a race or during like a quite a chaotic condition, they got always the good view about, you know, the strategy, where the other cars are, what's the best strategy to follow with the tires, and so on. So they are quite busy in extracting the maximum from the car, but they got some buffer left to think about everything else. Think about the strategy, think about the tires, and coming up, for example, with different strategies, suggesting to go with one stop while everyone is geared up for two stops or stuff like that. So those, for me, are signs of a big driver, of a big complete driver, that is not just about having a very quick lap in quali, but it's about, you know, all those things. Or like, for example, when there is a wet race with quite low grip and difficult conditions, show the raw speed there, not do any error, you know, overtake. You can see some races where you can see outliers. You can see drivers starting to, you know, be very, very quick, much more than before on dry. So those are signs for me of big drivers.
And with your technical head on, are all those drivers we've just listed, are they all technically strong? And part two of that question, how important these days with all the telemetry is it that a driver is technically strong?
Is a key advantage for the team to have a driver technically strong. Technically strong doesn't mean to give the solution. Technically strong, for me, is a driver that is able to highlight the car limitations, so where the car has to be improved, but then work well with the team, well with engineers, to put them in the right condition to extract the maximum. So that, for me, is a very technical, strong driver. It's not the driver that has got the solution, but it's driver that has got the right understanding of the limitation of the car, so suggesting areas to improve, areas to focus, and work well with engineers to extract the maximum.
That is fascinating. You don't want solutions, you just want explanations.
You want to understand where the limitations are, where the driver feels he could exploit more the lap time of the car, but he cannot for those reasons. You need to understand those points.
Can we role play this? Right, I'm the engineer, you're the driver, you've come back in after a run, and I'm now saying, right, Simone, tell me about the car. What sort of feedback are you going to give me that me, the engineer, is going to be happy to receive?
So I'm going to say, I don't know, I got this problem with the balance of the car. The car is not happy in high speed, for example, or I got this issue with the brakes. I got this issue with the steering, or in the long run, I can see some this shift of balance during the long run. So I'm highlighting you areas where I feel limited by the car, where I could go faster if I had something better in those areas. And then you are an engineer and you need to think about what to do and what to prepare, what to simulate, where to ask the support from the guys at the factory, for example, with the simulator, trying to do some work overnight and come back with a better solution for tomorrow.
Hey, I think you'd have been a great driver. Are you sure? Did you grow up wanting to be a driver? Was that ever on the cards for you?
Honestly, not. Honestly, I grew up close to Imola and about 30 kilometers from the racetrack. And on a good day, I could even hear the cars. You know, in the nice old days with the V12, etc., I could listen the noise even from 30 kilometers from my house. And I always wanted to be an engineer. And I tried very hard to be able to do that.
And you were always going to work in motor racing, weren't you? If that's what you grew up listening to.
It was a dream. It was a dream I wanted to fulfill. And I've been very lucky to be able to have this opportunity.
When did you see your first motor race live?
First motor race live, I think it was 1982 in Imola. So I think it was...
The controversial race between Gilles Villeneuve and Didier Pironi.
Yeah, this time.
You were watching that race at Imola?
No, not this one, but it's... or maybe 1983. I need to remember now. I wasn't prepared for that. But I was a mega fan of Ferrari. I remember I was like, crying in front of the TV on a bad race, etc. But they weren't very, very good years. Yeah, we were... having very bad results.
Living so close to Imola, were there some holiday jobs at the circuit or with Minardi who were based nearby?
The first opportunity I had was in 1996 in Minardi, doing a stage at the end of my university time. But then normally I was working always with my dad in the summer. We were doing little stuff, mechanical components. I was even able to going into the turning machine and doing some stuff, welding, going into the milling machine. So I was quite even able to have the hands-on approach that sometimes is missing from the engineer. So another key characteristic of an engineer, let's say, that is quite important and more difficult to find is to be an all-rounder. So being able to understand all the aspects, but not just very theoretical, also practical, understand like the components, looking at the parts, understand how they are produced and so on. So it's a... something that I developed when I was a teenager.
But Simone, isn't that one of the things we miss in Formula One now? You're of an age, an experience where having an understanding of the whole car was necessary. When you joined Minardi in 1998, there weren't that many engineers and technical people on the team. Whereas now it is much more specialized in all of the teams, isn't it? Do you think that is something that Formula One misses as a result?
If I look at the young engineers, the risk is to be too much specialized too quickly and to miss, let's say, the big picture, to miss the capacity to jump onto different things. And when I joined Minardi, at this point, I think we were about 80. More than half of the team was doing like a race team. So we were just a few of us designing and developing a car, doing crash tests developing the metallurgy or being stress engineers, doing kinematic work. And we were just a few of us. And... you learn probably in a bit more superficial way how to do everything. Then there is the time to learn how to do things better in a more sophisticated way, to start more lap time. But generally, the first years of your career are the years, say the first 2-3 years, where you really take your direction, define who you are, let's say, in the job, define what interests you, where you are at the best, let's say, giving some results, etc. So normally, the first 2-3 years are very critical, let's say, for development of your career. And then you keep continuing and refining and improving yourself. I was lucky enough to be able to have those years, let's say, in Minardi.
It's a great school for you.
Yes, definitely. It's a great school to become an all-rounder, to be able to do the job that after 3 years in Minardi, I went to Ferrari. Then all in a sudden, the job that I was doing was done maybe by 30 people, maybe even more. I mean, there were people at a very high level, so the job was probably more sophisticated, so you need to have more people and break down the job into multiple engineers. But that initial phase, let's say, in understanding how things go together, I think is quite key.
So without the Minardi experience, your first job in Formula One, you wouldn't be the engineer you are today? Is that fair?
We'll never know for sure. I think it's probably a fair way to say it. I mean, of course, if you are driven, if you are really keen in big organizations, and if you are lucky, let's say, to work with the right managers, you can develop yourself. And I can see a lot of things at Mercedes where you got very young talents that they start in some area, but they are able also to move into different areas and so develop themselves and grow even inside a very high competitive organization. Sometimes And this is my experience. I think that starting from a small organization has got some plus, and to give you this this big picture, let's say. But it's not given. I mean.
You left Minardi in 2001 to go to Ferrari. Were you at the team long enough to work with Alonso in 2001?
Basically, when he joined, initially he was a test driver, and then he's... I remember him, he was very, very young, very shy. He's, it was just the start of his career, but he was something special.
Was that obvious from day one?
Yes. Not for me that it was a young, let's say, engineer doing structural analysis and stuff like that, but I remember for Giancarlo Minardi, it was clear that it was a young talent.
He's always had, hasn't he, that ferocious tenacity.
Yeah. But he is a driver that I think he's got some of the characteristics that we discussed earlier. Being able to drive over the problems on the car, being able to compensate for it. I mean, of course, he's very fast. That's obvious. If not, he wouldn't be a world champion. But being able to have this kind of buffer of driving the car to the limit, but also think about everything around and being able to read the race and understand where to go, what to do.
Simone, you've had a fascinating insight into Alonso, actually. You saw him on his baby steps into Formula One with Minardi. Then, of course, you work with him when he joins Ferrari in 2010 as a double world champion. How different was the Ferrari version of Alonso?
He was quite a more mature driver, quite more confident. Of course, with the successes like that, you build your confidence more who you are and what you can do. He was a very, very quick driver that was able to always extract the maximum from the car at any point in time. I think it has been a very unfortunate, let's say, trajectory in those years in Ferrari, especially 2010 and 12. I think he would have deserved at least probably both of them or at least one of the two. But it has been quite an unfortunate outcome. But I think he's done a very nice job in those years. Very nice job.
Tell us a little more about what a culture shock it was for you going from Minardi, I think you said 80 people, the smallest team on the grid, to then join Ferrari in 2001 when they're dominating the sport with Michael Schumacher. Just how much of a culture shock was that for you as a young engineer?
Yeah, you know, I'm normally quite an humble person. Enter in a new organization like that with objective to learn, to grow, essentially be like a sponge, trying to understand everything, trying to be humble and see different ways of doing things, etc. Of course, it was a bit of a surprise to see that in some of the areas, the level was very, very, very high. So it was a very high level in some of the things. But in other things, I started to see things that maybe were better at Minardi. Formula One is full of talent, from the smallest team to the bigger team on the grid. Every team has got different people with different background, different characteristics, different history. And in every team, there is something better than in any other team. The difficult part is to find it and combine the best of all the worlds all together. But I remember some of the stuff we were doing at Minardi in some of the components. I mean, not big things, because we were struggling with the performance overall, but some of the things, some of the details were better at Minardi than at Ferrari.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yes,
the team that was dominating the sport in a way that we hadn't really seen before then. And you're saying that the smallest team on the grid was doing some things better.
Yeah, some details. I mean, of course, not big things. Probably, you know, in the overall balance, there weren't things that were making the difference. But every team has had and has got opportunities to improve it.
Simone, I often think of those early 2000s as peak Formula One, particularly at the front-running teams like Ferrari. You had, near as damn it, an unlimited budget. The technical regulations were very loose. How much more challenging is it today with the budget cap compared to back then? Because you could pursue any idea back then, almost any idea, right? Whereas now you have to be more selective.
Yeah, I suppose you're limited in terms of number of people, in terms of number of runs you can do, in terms of budget. Technical regulations, they've been more and more and more closed. So there's been a progressive convergence, let's say, between all the teams. Performance, let's say, with the way that the sport has been developed. And my feeling is that the Formula One is in one of the most competitive time of ever, let's say, of his history. I suppose the complexity is quite high. The teams, they are all very strong, and all those limitations like the budget cap and the technical regulations, etc., made things more difficult for everyone. So the competition is at one of his highest level ever, in my opinion, now.
And although you don't have the budget to do as many wind tunnel runs, for example. Is the technical challenge still as high today as it was 20, 30 years ago?
I think it's very high. Probably it's a bit different in the way that technical freedom is quite reduced. Probably sometime the performance is in the more extreme optimization rather than having like a white sheet of paper and having a lot of freedom in doing different things. So there's still freedom. There's still quite a lot of freedom and likely the cars quite a bit different one to the other. But yeah, if I remember when I was younger, the freedom was much higher than now.
I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
There's more from Simone shortly, but first, a word on F1's other official podcasts. F1 Nation's review of the Monaco Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Alex Brundle and Diego Mejia for a chat about that mandatory two-stop race. And on F1 Explains, double world champion Mika Hakkinen is answering your questions. You can listen to the shows right here after you finish with Simone. Can we talk about culture now? Team culture? Because Mercedes is the first British-based team that you've raced with in Formula One. Haas, Sauber, lots of years at Ferrari, Minardi. How different is the UK experience for you, and how different is the culture at the team compared to, say, Ferrari?
It's quite remarkably different. I'm really enjoying it. It has been 6 months, so still at the start of this incredible journey, but I'm really enjoying it. Mercedes is an English team, like you said, but it's also quite an international team. There's a lot of different nationalities in the team, and there's a mix of different experiences, which makes the team even stronger. And there's a very nice atmosphere in the team, and I'm really enjoying it.
Why did you join Mercedes? Why now?
You know, in my career, I've had many times the dilemma about what I was doing, and I never felt it was the right time. But then when the moment...
The right time to join an English team?
The right time to leave and to change completely my career. And, you know, I've been a Ferrari employee for 24 years. I've been working for them, mainly on the Ferrari project, but also on other projects, always part of the Ferrari family. End of 23, and I felt for the first time very loud the voice in me that it was the time to change it. And I just went for it. I needed a different challenge. A really fresh start with different objectives, different organization, different people. It's always difficult to change, But really, when you go out of your comfort zone, you understand that the world is very big and there is a lot of great things to see. There are a lot of great people in the paddock to know and to become colleague with and to enjoy the time together. And they're really enjoying this time, really, really happy.
I'm thinking of another great Italian engineer, Aldo Costa, did a similar thing to you. Did you ring him? Did you seek any reassurance from anyone who's done a change like that before?
I mean, me and Aldo are good friends, and we remained always good friends in all the evolution of our careers. Before he was my boss, he's been my boss for several years, and then he left to Mercedes, I was a Ferrari, but we always remained friends. And we've been also working together when I was leading the AS program, and he was back at Dallara, for example. So in many different ways, we always kept in contact and remained a friend, and I always rate very high his opinion. He's a very good person.
And did he say, go for it?
I think he would never say it. He will never try to influence you in your decision, but he will always try to help you in giving some suggestion and some information.
And I suppose you've worked with James Allison before at Ferrari.
Yeah, we worked two times together. In the beginning with a very young James, when he was in this first experience, and then he left to Renault.
Oh, when he was like the aerodynamicist.
Yeah, he was the track side aerodynamicist. Yeah, sometimes he could even come into a meeting with the shorts. And that young James, I remember him pretty well. But also we worked together in a very intense time at Ferrari when we were trying to come back after a difficult start in 14. So we were working together during 15, 16, trying to rebuild the project and improve it. And we were just able to work very close together. And that relationship and friendship remained, during the years.
And what about the team principal at Ferrari during the time you were there? There were quite a few. Jean Todt, Stefano Domenicali, Maurizio Riva Bene, etc. How different is Toto Wolff to your bosses at Ferrari?
I've been working with under the leadership of Toto for 6 months now. I think he has got a unique combination of leadership, of managerial characteristics, but also of racing understanding. So for one that has been a driver when he was young, etc., so he's got that very good understanding about how a racing car is and how to work on it, and is a unique manager in our sport at the moment.
There's been an interesting development in Formula One in the last few years where there are a lot of engineers have become team principals. I'm thinking of Andy Cowell at Aston Martin is an example of that. Yet you have Toto, who isn't an engineer. He has a bit of a racing background, as you say. Pros and cons of that? Would you like to work for an engineer as your boss or more of a racer like Toto?
It's funny because you're asking me things that I never asked myself, let's say, so far. So there's never the perfect solution. The perfect organization comes as a result of the people that you got and how you can extract the maximum from all of them. And there are organizations where maybe a team principal is an engineer, but then you got a CEO to look for other things. We got Toto that is joining both, let's say, the CEO and the team principal duties. Every organization is different and is shaped around the talent of the people that you got in the organization. I think there is not a single solution, but it's all down to individuals, characteristics, and then how to put them in the best way to express their talent and how to work the organization around it. That's my opinion, my experience.
And how are you finding the Englishness of the Mercedes Formula One team? I know there's multinationals working there, but the full English breakfast when you go into the motorhome in the morning, the cappuccinos after lunch, the fish and chips. Lewis Hamilton actually was quite rude about the British culinary experience. He says, now I'm at Ferrari, I get proper food. I think he's been doing us down, quite frankly.
Honestly, I will not cheat. And I will always take the breakfast in the Italian way. So we'll always go for like a pasta or croissant, like the French way. I will never take the sausage or the eggs in the morning. I will probably never take a cappuccino after 11 in the morning. And this, actually, very often we discuss and joke about that in the team. And I think the best winning teams are always the teams where you can combine together all the experiences and all the diversities from everyone and extract the best from everyone together. That's the winning formula for me.
I can see you're relishing this new challenge. Are you living in Oxford? Are you enjoying that side of life in the UK?
Yeah, technically I'm living in Oxford. During the weekend I got a lot of commuting UK to Italy in the weekend to see my family, and I really like it. I see it very little, to be honest, because I'm always at work or around with planes, etc. But it's very nice. It's a very nice area.
I did just want to ask you, a man of your experience in this sport, from an engineering standpoint, which era since 1998 has been the most interesting for you?
Normally, I'm a very curious person. I like freedom. I like to be able to develop different things. And I tend to say that eras where there was a lot of technical freedom were very exciting for me, because you could do a lot of different things, and actually the different teams were maybe developing different areas. You know, year after year, that freedom has got reduced, and so teams are working more and more on the same things, just with a different direction or different sophistication. So if I was to choose, probably I would say that the more freedom we got, the better it is for me. At the end of the day, let's say, Formula One is unique. It's like the top, in my opinion, in terms of technical development. It's just different objectives. It's just different opportunities. And every phase, every year is different, but it's always exciting.
Give me a year to latch onto. Which was your favorite
early
year?
2000s.
Early 2000s.
Yeah. Full freedom. You could decide to invest in wind tunnels, doing like full-scale cars. You could decide to do 100,000 kilometers on the track and do entire testing. You could decide to do suspensions or traction control or whatever. Full freedom on everything. Yeah, no curfew, no limitations. You could work very, very hard. You could work in one, two, three different wind tunnels at the same time. You could have multiple test teams into different tracks.
Tire war,
flat out, completely. It was a very wild and exciting experience.
But kind of unsustainable, wasn't it? Long term.
Yeah, not sustainable. Or probably for the goodness of the sport, where you want to see, on merit, more and more cars fighting together. Not as a given, but like on merit, it wasn't probably sustainable. Yeah, it was very difficult.
So that was then, and just throwing it forward to 26, do you think one team will steal a march on everyone else? Or do you think we're going to have a close season next year like we have now?
To be honest, if I had the crystal ball, I would probably do something different in my life, but it's very difficult to predict. But it's, I feel is even if the regulations remain quite restrictive in the freedom that you got, I think it's a big opportunity for a reset in the sport, and is a key year for everyone to try to get it right and to start opening a new cycle with a competitive car.
And when you have big rule changes, I guess there is always the chance, isn't there, for one team?
The chance, but also the risk to get it wrong. It's quite a key moment, let's say, in the next few years.
Exciting times ahead. Final question, and this is something I'm asking everybody on the podcast this year. It's the 75th anniversary, of course, of Formula One. Can you please pick a favourite moment in the 75-year history of Formula One? Is there one moment that stands out to you?
For me, seeing Michael, after so many years, being able to win for Ferrari the first title, I think it was a great moment for our sport. He tried so hard, and for one reason or the other, he failed a few times, and then he was able to do it. He kept pushing and kept believing in it, and he did it. That for me was a great moment in our sport.
Simone, thank you very much for your time. Great to chat.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You won't be alone in thinking that, Simone. When Michael clinched that title at Suzuka in 2000, the Ferrari garage went into meltdown. I remember it so clearly. I've never seen so many tears and so much emotion in a pit garage. It was wonderful. As was this conversation. I love talking to Simone. He's so interesting about so many things in Formula One, and he has the experience to back it up. I loved it when he said Minardi were doing some things better than Ferrari. And you never know, that could mean we're in for a surprise when the regs change next year. One of the smaller teams could just do it better than one of the big teams. Can't wait. Simone, many thanks for your time. It was great to chat, and I'll see you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this episode. A quick parish notice before I go. Tickets for F1 The Movie are out now. Go to f1themovie.com to book your seats. I saw it last week in Monaco and really enjoyed it. So don't miss the chance to see it yourselves on the big screen. f1themovie.com is the place to go for tickets. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
. 2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.